From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. There are those observers inside and outside the LDS Church who keep track of certain progressive momentum within Mormonism. And it seems like the best time to make an accounting of this sort of thing is at the faith's semi-annual general conference. For these people, there were speeches at the conference this past weekend that represented significant steps forward. One acknowledged the fallibility of individual church leaders. Another one offered a sympathetic view of mental illness, particularly depression. But others saw some steps back, or just no movement at all on gay rights, for example, or women's rights. Today in the program, we're talking about what was said and what wasn't over the weekend, and we invite you to join us after this news.
Hi, this is Elaine Clark, one of the producers of Radio West. Our free podcasts are made possible by KUER's generous listeners. If you're a fan, we hope you'll consider joining them. Become a sustaining member of KUER for as little as $5 a month. Visit us online at KUER.org for details. Thank you.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. There are a number of challenges facing the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints in the 21st century. There are the physical problems of managing resources for a worldwide faith of some 15 million members. There are the constant spiritual dynamics of worship and devotion. And then there are the social issues, how to deal with members, for example, who are losing their faith as they're exposed to information on the internet, how to deal with church members who are gay, some of whom want to get married, how to deal with women within the church who are asking to play a larger role in church administration and leadership, some who want to be ordained within the church's priesthood. If you're keeping track of any of these issues, there was something for you at this past weekend's general conference for the church. Mormon leaders addressed doubting members. They acknowledged that authorities make mistakes. One brought up mental illness and depression. Others, though, seemed determined to hold the line on gay marriage and women's rights. So today in the program, we're exploring some of these issues on some of the speeches and what they tell us about the progress of Mormonism. We invite you to join the conversation. 801-585-WEST is the number, 801-585-9378. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. We should mention that as we were putting this program together, we talked with a spokesperson from the church. We mentioned some of the people who were going to join us on the program today, and we invited them to participate. This morning, we received this statement in response. The church is continually engaged in important conversations about our beliefs and practices, including takeaways from General Conference. However, a group of critics known for their personal agendas does not provide a forum for a reasonable and balanced discussion. And I should confess, it's a little frustrating that they declined to participate in the program and would not offer someone to balance that discussion, but we understand, and we've extended a formal and an open invitation to have a representative of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints join us at any time. We'll even give them the entire program. That seems fair. Again, 801-585-WEST, the number to join us. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Joining us today in the program is Joanna Brooks, who blogs about Mormonism at the online magazine ReligionDispatches.org. She's also the author of the memoir, The Book of Mormon Girl, Stories from an American Faith. She's a professor of English and comparative literature at San Diego State University, is joining us by phone from her office in San Diego. Joanna Brooks, welcome back. Thanks for being with us.
Hi, Doug. Thank you for having me.
John DeLynn is back with us. He's creator and host of Mormon Stories. It's a podcast that focuses on Mormon faith and culture. He's a PhD candidate in psychology at Utah State University. He's joining us from Utah Public Radio there in Logan. And John DeLynn, welcome back to you.
Thanks, Doug. And hi, Joanna.
Rosalind Welch is with us, an independent scholar focusing on philosophy, theology, and literature. She writes about Mormonism for the online religion magazine Patheos and for the St. Louis Dispatch. Also blogs at the Mormon blog Times and the Seasons. And Rosalind Welch is joining us from her home in St. Louis. That's where she lives. Rosalind Welch, welcome to you. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you very much. I'm glad to be here.
Well, we'll get to the particulars as we go, but let me start broadly. John DeLynn, let me start with you. What were you hearing over the weekend at the LDS Church's General Conference? Just your sort of general kind of reaction first.
Yeah, well, on Saturday, I had several moments of deep and intense elation and excitement. We've been hoping for a member of the First Presidency in General Conference to acknowledge that those who struggle with historical, doctrinal, or social issues in the church do so for credible reasons and not for having been offended or, you know, having their feelings hurt or wanting to sin or other types of justifications that are often attributed to those who struggle. And not only did he acknowledge that, but he also expressed the desire to have a really big tent within the church. He encouraged us to, you know, people like us to want to stay. That was just a huge triumphant victory for those of us who have been trying to be understood. Then Elder Holland followed up by destigmatizing mental illness and depression, acknowledging that simplistic answers like, you know, pray and fast and read the scriptures are often not going to be helpful for those who are struggling from severe mental illness. And then his encouraging of Mormons to seek professional help is just a huge step forward. And so that excitement that many of us felt was counterbalanced, unfortunately, by some of the messages that were mentioned on Sunday.
And we'll get to those, as we said, particularly references to women and their roles, references to gay people as well. Joanna Brooks, what did you think?
I also was celebrating on Saturday morning. I was deeply touched. President Uchtdorf's message really demonstrated some prophetic leadership in speaking to a profound hunger among Mormons who have studied church history and come up with profound and intractable questions. He modeled a way for us to see the humanity of the Mormon past and to do it without apology, to do it with dignity, to say, he said, this is a faith that has had a 200-year unbroken stream of, you know, wonderful deeds and divine acts and inspiration, and there have also been human errors. He was very plain-spoken about the fact that Mormon members and leaders have said and done things that are not in keeping with core gospel principles, thereby basically freeing all LDS people from having to perform, you know, apologetics or kind of uncomfortable gymnastics to account for, you know, problems in the Mormon past, like the denial of priesthood to people of African descent. I mean, for the first time, we have a model in the church's highest leadership of how to say mistakes were made.
Rosalind Welch, I'm wondering, did you feel the same sense that you're hearing from Joanna and John, a sense of kind of elation on Saturday, and then maybe not quite sure how you felt on some of the talks you heard on Sunday? How are you feeling about it all?
You know, I was thinking if this conference were an item on a Chinese restaurant menu, it would definitely be the sweet and sour chicken, right? It had the sweet elements, and then it had the sour elements, depending on which side of the spectrum you stand on. As Latter-day Saints, we revere our leaders and we love them, and their words can touch us in a way that almost nothing else can. And for that reason, I think General Conference addresses can provoke these extremes of emotion, from, you know, the extremes of elation when they say what we want to hear. It feels so good when we hear them say what we want to hear. To the other extremes of despair and alienation when what they say is hard for us to hear. And because people that I love were hurt by some of those messages, it hurts me as well. On the other hand, I think that there is a real power that comes in prophetic discourse from being able to speak the hard things, sometimes from challenging us, shaking us for a moment out of our preferred worldview. I think that's the power of a prophet to witness in the modern world. And whether or not, you know, you agree on this subject or the other, there were talks that I felt that elation, talks where I felt that sting. But I was glad to have an occasion to be shaken up and to really feel and to really think and to escape for a moment from sort of my own preferred set of worldviews.
Joanna Brooks, what do you think this reveals about the leadership itself, the the dynamic that must be going on within the Quorum of the Twelve and the First Presidency related to a kind of strategy that they present to the world. Do you get a sense that there are there's a sense that there's a kind of fact, there are these factions. You have the kind of progressive faction represented by certain speeches, and you have the sort of hardline faction represented by other speeches. Boyd K. Packer is one to mention, and we'll get to Dallin Oaks as well. Does this give you some insight into that kind of give and take that may be going on within the hierarchy?
You know, I've never claimed to have special insight into what's happening in the church office building. I'm not someone who has friends and relatives in high places. You know? But I want to take President Uchtdorf's very helpful framing. If we see Mormon history in its human dimensions, then we can see, even in the diversity and points of friction in perspectives presented over the weekend at conference, we can see a robust conversation taking place among leaders who are deeply concerned for the welfare of the Mormon people. And even in moments where their messages collide, for example, the warm, broadly welcoming spirit of President Uchtdorf's talk and some of the harder line notes hit by Elders Oaks and Christofferson, you know, even in those points of divergence, we can see continuing revelation at work in its human dynamics. Continuing revelation happens when people disagree with one another and seek answers. That's what I take away.
John, what about you? What do you see about that give and take dynamic within the church expressed in, you know, those public talks?
Yeah, I felt very similarly to Joanna. You know, Elder Uchtdorf, I had a listener from the podcast write this quote. Uchtdorf reached out to me, then Oaks reminded me why I'll never go back. There was the presiding bishop saying that we should welcome all members through the doors of the church. And that very Saturday, 200 women were denied the chance to attend the priesthood session. And so it must be that the brethren are trying very hard to walk the line between maintaining loyal and faithful to the prophetic statements and the scriptural interpretations that have been made in the past, while listening to the challenges and the issues that many of us face in modernity and trying to find some balance. And for me, the most encouraging thing about the entire weekend was the message that they are clearly listening. It is clear to me, I have a 99.9% confidence that President Uchtdorf has been listening to the messages that are being sent. It was very clear to me when they opened up the priesthood session on the internet to anyone who wants to listen, that they were listening to the women of the ordained movement saying that we need to be more open and inclusive here. Just like last April, they listened and allowed women to pray in General Conference for the first time. So for me, one of the most exciting messages is that they're listening, but also that they have to give mixed messages because they're trying to maintain their base while also accommodating progressive sensibilities. So it's a tough line that they walk, and I'm glad to know that they're listening.
Is that the struggle, Rosalind Welch, trying to maintain the base and yet still be appealing, acceptable to, I don't want to make this ideological, but the conservative wing, put it that way?
Yeah, I think that's right. I think that the brethren have shown that they want to be as accommodating as they can, and that they are listening. And yet, I hear real sincerity in their voices when they say there are some things that we cannot change. So I have no doubt that they are feeling that squeeze and are trying to figure out what can we do, what accommodations, what compromises can we make that we believe are authorized and available to us right now. It was interesting, I thought, to compare Sister Stevens, who spoke on Saturday morning, her response to an implicit response to the ordained women movement with Elder Christofferson's. And I think when you compare those two, you can sort of see this search for a framing device that is going to connect. And it's a very difficult job. Sister Stevens sort of took an institutional approach, talking about men and women working cooperatively within the institution of the church, whereas Elder Christofferson kind of doubled down on a sort of gender essentialism that, you know, women and men are inherently and deeply different as individuals. These are two very different approaches to making sense of an all-male priesthood. And I think you sort of sense that they're trying to find the frame that is going to reach out and connect with young women in particular. It's not an easy task.
Before we get to a break, I do want to play some excerpts from some of these speeches as we go along. And we've been referring to Dieter Uchtdorf's speech. And I want to play an excerpt from this. I guess we don't really need to set it up beyond what's been said. A lot of reaction from people to this talk given by Uchtdorf. Let me play an excerpt from that.
One might ask, if the gospel is so wonderful, why would anyone leave? Sometimes we assume it is because they have been offended or lazy or sinful. Actually, it is not that simple. In fact, there's not just one reason that applies to the variety of situations. Some struggle with unanswered questions about things that have been done or said in the past. We openly acknowledge that in nearly 200 years of church history, along with an uninterrupted line of inspired, honorable, and divine events, there have been some things said and done that could cause people to question. And to be perfectly frank, there have been times when members or leaders in the church have simply made mistakes. There may have been things said or done that were not in harmony with our values, principles, or doctrine.
Now, we edited some of that. I wanted to mention there were, but those were the sort of critical excerpts that I think that people have been talking about. Before we head into a break, Joanna Brooks, and actually all of you, why is this important? For those uninitiated, why would that be so significant, what he said? Because all he really did say was, gosh, leaders in the past have made mistakes. Why is that a big deal?
I think, even though we have always professed, that there is no prophetic infallibility and that prophets are men who are, the Lord speaks to them in their own language, in practice, it has been very, very difficult to apply that. I think there's been an unrealistic culture of authority at the local levels and at the general levels, expecting perfection from our leaders. Even though we know that they don't need to be perfect. I love that now Elder Uchtdorf has given us the language, as Joanna said, to express that in a way that will not raise any red flags. It won't mark you as an apostate because Elder Uchtdorf said it, that our leaders are human and there have been mistakes that are made. And I think that will contribute to a much more pragmatic and productive culture of authority in the church going forward.
Joanna.
And in a broad historical and cultural frame, Doug, for 170 years, Mormons and our leaders have been ridiculed in mainstream American society for a belief in prophetic authority. And many members, have adopted deeply defensive postures towards the outside world. And, with the advent of the digital age, with more and more members having access to, portions of Mormon history, those who raise questions have been treated as outsiders, have been pushed out, and that old defensive posture resumed. Elder Uchtdorf, perhaps by virtue of being a convert, perhaps by virtue of not being raised in the United States, brings us a wonderful, refreshing non-defensiveness and allows us to step past that defensive posture of our history and engage in a much more, as Rosalind said, pragmatic and human discussion about the beauties and the dark episodes in our history.
John?
I'll just add that for the people that I often speak with who are challenged and struggling in their faith, the most common visceral reaction that a believing family member or friend will offer is, what sin have you committed? Are you looking at pornography? Are you cheating on your spouse? You must have not ever believed it to begin with. And the research that we did and the study at whymormonsquestion.org makes it really clear that these people who struggle in their faith are former bishops, former stake presidents and stake presidency members and former mission presidents. These are former Relief Society presidents and young women's presidents. They're among the best and brightest that our church can offer. And so it's deeply hurtful to have everyone around you assume that you've done something evil or pernicious or slothful, when in reality you're being driven by legitimate concerns that are heartfelt. And so him providing a little bit of cover for that hopefully will take a little bit of the pressure off. And those who are struggling can say, look what President Uchtdorf said. Please don't judge me. Please don't harass me. Please listen to me, because my concerns are legitimate and they deserve compassion, not judgment.
Let me take a call. 801-585-WEST is the number to join us. We're running behind. I knew we would. 801-585-WEST is the number to join us. Jonathan is with us in Bountiful. Jonathan, welcome.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I wanted to know what your panel's thoughts was about the role of apologetics in the church. Joanna Brooks suggested that apologetics might no longer be necessary because of President Uchtdorf's talk. And John DeLynn has been very critical of certain prominent apologists in the church, even attempting to censor a publication of one apologist using his own connections when that publication was critical of him. And I'll take my answer off the air.
Well, John, it sounds like that was directed to you. A little accusation there. I'll give you a chance to respond. But Joanna, first, to the bigger question, is it going to change now the way the church tries to defend itself if, in fact, there's a concession that, hey, we blew it in the past, and so there won't be such a intense sense of apologetics?
There is a very devoted set of, you know, lay historical scholars and theologians who feel a real sense of purpose and mission in trying to present difficult episodes in Mormon history and answer sometimes very cruelly and crudely posed, you know, ridicule and criticism of the church. And they've had, you know, little institutional support from church leaders in that, you know, as recently as February 2012, when a minor scandal around racist remarks by BYU professor, you know, emerged in the Washington Post, church leaders have, you know, official church statements have hedged on the question of whether or not prophets ever make mistakes, whether or not church leaders ever said unsavory things. They really have worked hard in that gap with little support. I'm interested to see where the very dedicated men and women of, you know, of Fair Mormon and other apologetic organizations go next. How they feel their work is redefined by a humanizing of the Mormon past.
And John, so Jonathan took a bit of a cheap shot there, so I want to give you a chance to, he didn't tell us, that's what I mean by cheap, that he was going to say that, and I don't want to adjudicate that now. You want to say something about it?
Yeah.
Just make something brief.
Absolutely.
Response.
Thank you, Doug. I actually believe that apologetics still has a very important place within Mormonism. If you look at the people who currently staff the Maxwell Institute today, if you look at you know, Claudia and Richard Bushman or Fiona and Taro Givens, these are wonderful, insightful, thoughtful defenders of the faith. And I believe we need more of them, and that's why we created a podcast called A Thoughtful Faith, to explore people who were thoughtful but also faithful. What we don't need are apologists who are going to do exactly what President Uchtdorf urged us not to do, which is to judge and attack those who have sincere and earnest questions. The publication that Jonathan mentioned was a 100-plus page article that was being written about me, pulling quotes and comments from my Facebook page and elsewhere to try and malign my character. I didn't try and censor it. All I did is I made one general authority aware of the publication, and he took it upon himself to go to the president of BYU and to others and to ask the question, is this the type of thing that the church should be sponsoring? And I'm very pleased to say that these church leaders, and I understand that an apostle was involved in the decision, they made the decision not only that that type of apologetics wasn't welcome in the church, but that the types of people who were sponsoring it probably needed to find new employment.
Okay.
And I think that's a wonderful decision, and I support it.
Didn't want to quite get off into the weeds there. But Jonathan, thank you very much. 801-585-WEST. Again, the number to join the conversation. John DeLynn with us, creator of the Mormon Stories podcast. Joanna Brooks blogs about Mormonism at religiondispatches.org. She's also the author of the book, The Book of Mormon Girl, Stories from an American Faith. And Rosalind Welsh is with us for the first time. She blogs about Mormonism at Times and Seasons, is a columnist for the online religion magazine Patheos. We'll take a break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. Thank you. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we are talking about what was said and what wasn't at the latest general conference of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. If you're an observer of how Mormonism is adapting to certain modern challenges, there's a lot to talk about in the speeches over the weekend. That's what we're doing. 801-585-WEST is the number to join us. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. On Saturday, Mormon women made headlines when they stood in line at the LDS Church's conference center to get tickets to the faith's priesthood session. That session has been limited to men and boys, but one by one, some 130 or 150 women organized by the group Ordain Women were turned away. There were a number of speeches that were directed at the role of women, one of them given by Elder D. Todd Christofferson. He's of the governing Quorum of the 12 Apostles, and Christofferson spoke about what he called the moral influence of women, how important it was, he said, that they have been the civilizing influence in society. But he also mentioned what he called trends and forces at work that he said weaken or eliminate a woman's influence. Among them was this.
A pernicious philosophy that undermines women's moral influence is the devaluation of marriage and of motherhood and homemaking as a career. Some feminist thinkers view homemaking with outright contempt, arguing it demeans women and that the relentless demands of raising children are a form of exploitation. They ridicule what they call the mommy track as a career. This is not fair or right. We do not diminish the value of what women or men achieve in any worthy endeavor or career. We all benefit from those achievements. But we still recognize there's not a higher good than motherhood and fatherhood and marriage. There is no superior career, and no amount of money, authority, or public acclaim can exceed the ultimate rewards of family. Whatever else a woman may accomplish, her moral influence is no more optimally employed than here.
Let me get some response from people. I want to introduce another guest here as we go along. But first, Joanna Brooks, give me your response to what you heard, not just there, but more generally about women at the conference over the weekend.
You know, it's clear that at the same moment that church leaders are very concerned about welcoming members who have questions, there's a very robust conversation among our leaders about gender issues. You know, in the 1840s, Joseph Smith told Mormon women, "You would make of us a kingdom of priests," and we still have basically no idea what he meant when he said that. Gender and the role of women in church administration and leadership is the great unfinished business of the Restoration. And this weekend, I think we saw our leaders trying their very best to shore up the rhetorics and logics we've used to support the status quo, a status quo in which administrative decisions all up and down the chain of command are made by men only. That's not always the way it's been in Mormonism, but it is what we have now, and we see, you know, just a great deal of struggle both among people at the grassroots and our leaders to, you know, understand what God's will is on this question.
Rosalind Welch, what did you hear in that?
Well, yes. I mean, we heard things that we have heard before, echoing language from the Proclamation on the Family about gender being an essential characteristic. This idea drives some people wild to distraction. For others, it seems so obviously self-evident as to be sort of the basis of their entire worldview. So it's hard to see where those two extremes meet. It's interesting. I've heard it speculated that the missionary age change will eventually work to really change the gender culture within the church. That may be the case, mm-hmm. but I think what we're seeing now is that it isn't happening yet. This kind of language, it doesn't drive me wild. It does describe in some ways my understanding and my experience in the world. I did appreciate that he used gender-inclusive language about both mothers and fathers, their greatest work being motherhood and fatherhood, much more important and much greater than any career success. That rings true for me. I also appreciated sort of where the far edge of social conservatism and the far edge of feminism meet, which is in recognizing sort of the scourge of sexually objectified imagery in our culture, which really poses such a threat to the spirits and the psyches of our young women. Of course, what to do about that problem, they differ greatly, but I think we can find common ground in being aware and worried about that trend.
Let me get another voice involved in the conversation. John, I'm going to leave you out for a moment for obvious reasons. You're not a woman.
Okay.
But we'll come back to you. Kate Kelly is with us, the founder of Ordain Women, a grassroots group of Mormons aimed at gender equality within the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. She's based in Washington, D.C., joining us from her office there. She, of course, was involved in the she was in line, put it that way, on Saturday to get some of those tickets and was turned away. Kate Kelly, welcome back. Thanks for being with us.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So, looking back, you, of course, I suppose you expected to be turned away on Saturday trying to get tickets for the priesthood session. What do you feel like as you're reflecting now? What do you feel like you accomplished with that?
To be perfectly honest with you, Doug, I was expecting to be let in. Some people have called me a delusional optimist. I felt that if we presented ourselves in a sincere way, and if they could see us, and they could see our tears, and they could see our faces, that perhaps we would be let in to the priesthood session. So I didn't realize, actually, until I got up to the door, how much faith and sincerity and hope I had approaching the priesthood session. So I honestly did think that we would be let in, at least to the tabernacle, to watch it remotely.
Hmm.
And so it was. I guess we've discussed in the conversation earlier on, a sweet and sour experience. It was both so sweet and amazing to see, you know, the 150 to 200 women who supported us and came out in person, and it was also so sour and bitter to be turned away.
Did you see the fact that church leaders decided to now, I mean, this was significant, at least for some, to broadcast it online and I think on KBYU, too? Did you see that as a concession? Did you feel like that was a concession on their part?
I think it's a great step forward. We appreciated the opportunity to watch the priesthood session live and watched it, you know, on our cell phones in the park after we were turned away. And I think that's a really great step forward for the church to acknowledge that women should be included. Our goal was to attend in person, to hear the words of our prophet and our leaders in person. And, I see this as a great step forward.
One thing I noticed, I wonder if anyone else noticed this, President Uchtdorf, in the priesthood session, he kept saying, rather than just referring to brethren, he kept referring to friends. Did you notice that? Is that significant at all, or am I just missing it?
I think any step forward using inclusive language for like was mentioned, Elder Christofferson mentioned not only motherhood, but also fatherhood as being important. I think Elder Uchtdorf in many ways is a hero of people with questions and seeking answers. And so any step forward, including women and men in language or using neutral terms, I think is really welcome and really needed.
So a step forward in some ways. What did you make of Elder Christofferson's talk and the talk of others, among them Elder Quentin Cook, is for example?
I think that we're hearing a lot of the usual lines of reasoning, and we're hearing a lot of the things we've heard in the past. I think the church and its leaders are really struggling to grapple with gender issues and gender equality, and now that they're seeing that there are hundreds, even thousands of women speaking out on our website, ordainwomen.org, and speaking in public on the issue of women's ordination, I think they really are trying to struggle with this and you know, make amends or tie the two together. And, you know, in some ways I see what he said as a straw man argument, because we certainly aren't arguing that motherhood isn't important. It's extremely important. The vast majority of women who have their profiles up on our site, ordainwomen.org, are mothers, are grandmothers. And so I think that we value that role just as importantly as anyone else in the church. And we see fatherhood as equally important, and parenting in general as one of our most precious and valued things we can do on this earth. However, priesthood is separate and apart from gender, and also separate from any potential parenthood.
and I agree with Kate that we're seeing, you know, struggle evidenced in the divergence in the messages. Just look at, on Sunday morning, Elder Cook almost raised, you know, arms in a victory sign over the pulpit saying, we're so thrilled to see women achieving in every field of endeavor. And yet just the day before, Elder Christofferson had delivered a really unfortunate and really inaccurate caricature of feminism as being opposed to motherhood as a career when, you know, feminism make possible women's achievement in many fields of endeavor through securing the right to vote and education. And there is contradiction in the messages we're hearing and a return to what Rosalind called a gender essentialism, which was sort of introduced into Mormon theology with the proclamation of 1995.
Kate Kelly, we're having problems with your phone line, so we're going to let you go. Thank you very much for joining us. Founder of Ordain Women joined us from her office in Washington, D.C. We have Joanna Brooks with us. We have John DeLynn. We have Rosalind Welch as well. And we need to take another break. 801-585-WEST, the number, our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about what was said over the weekend at the semi-annual general conference of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. I should mention again that we spoke with a spokesperson from the church, asked them to provide someone to join us today. They declined to participate. Sent us a statement, which we read earlier on the program. John DeLynn is with us, creator of Mormon Stories podcast. Joanna Brooks blogs about Mormonism at religiondispatches.org. Rosalind Welch with us, blogs about Mormonism at Times and Seasons. And 801-585-WEST, the number to join the conversation. I want to play an excerpt from a clip that some people have referred to, and this was a clip by Jeffrey R. Holland of the Quorum of the Twelve Apostles. Holland mentions mental illness and emotional disorders in general. In particular, he talked about in his talk major depressive disorder or depression. Holland makes it clear that he wasn't talking about, as he said, bad hair days or tax deadlines or discouraging moments. He said that he had seen it in everyone, in students, adults, and veterans, even in himself.
And I've seen it in young fathers trying to provide for their families. In that regard, I once terrifyingly saw it in myself. At one point in our married life, when financial fears collided with staggering fatigue, I took a psychic blow that was as unanticipated as it was real. With the grace of God and the love of my family, I kept functioning and kept working, but even after all these years, I continue to feel a deep sympathy for others more chronically or more deeply afflicted with such gloom than I was. In any case, we've all taken courage from those who, in the words of the prophet Joseph, searched and contemplated the darkest abyss and persevered through it. Not the least of which were Abraham Lincoln, Winston Churchill, and Elder George Albert Smith, the latter being one of the most gentle and Christ-like men of our dispensation, who battled recurring depression for several years before later becoming the universally beloved eighth prophet and president of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints.
Joanna Brooks, what's significant about the fact that Holland mentions the name George Albert Smith and refers to himself and his own experience? What's significant about that for you?
Well, again, as with President Uchtdorf's prophetic remarks on Saturday, it goes to the issue of the humanity of Mormon leaders. It humanizes the lives of faith that Mormons live. It humanizes struggle. It acknowledges that depression, mental illness, are, you know, a part of mortal experience. And Elder Holland's admission that he himself had struggled as a man gender, depression has been gendered. So his acknowledgement that men too suffer depression, tremendously freeing for members who suffer and for those who love them.
John DeLynn, what did you think?
You know, I believe that Elder Holland's talk is an apostle at his best. And what I mean by that is the church has made a statement that the core doctrine of Mormonism is Christ and love. And Christ's message was love and empathy and compassion for those who are struggling. And so when Elder Holland takes a population that's been told, just cheer up and have a positive attitude, you know, just pray and read your scriptures and you'd be fine. Sometimes that's what people think about people who are depressed. And as somebody who's in the last year of my PhD in clinical psychology, I know that depression and anxiety and other disorders can be crippling. And so for him to not only acknowledge that he's experienced it, but also to encourage more empathy and love, we need more of this. If the apostles could focus on this type of talk, they're only going to build more love and support within the membership and do more good for those that I know they mean to help. So I was very happy with it. I just can't say enough good things.
Let's take a call. 801-585-WEST. Again, the number to join the conversation. Megan has been waiting a long time in San Clemente, California. Megan, sorry for the wait. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Sure.
As a Mormon feminist who has suffered from depression before, I thought this conference was really exciting. And especially Holland's comments that were just reiterated. I faced a lot of misunderstanding, especially on my mission as an LDS missionary and a mission president who didn't understand mental illness. And lots of members, and I've tried to just speak very openly about it. And I've seen a lot of change in the last, especially 5 years. And this talk was very necessary. I know a lot of people that are still suffering. Luckily, my episodes were temporary, and I've had a baby, and I haven't had any postpartum, and I may suffer in the future, but I just was so happy to hear this talk and other talks, too, that addressed both doctrine about Mormon feminism. I mean, it wasn't all grand. There were some that kept that essentialism, but I saw a lot of really good things. I was very happy.
Glad you called. Thanks very much, Megan. Not a great line from Megan, but I hope you heard what she was able to say. 801-585-WEST, the number two, join the conversation. I want to shift gears a little bit here and to talk. I want to play a clip from Elder Dallin H. Oaks. Here's what he had to say. I mean, this question comes up for some who are looking at for progressive momentum within Mormonism. You see steps forward, and some saw what Elder Oaks had to say this weekend as a step back related to gay marriage to gay people. Let me play something from Elder Dallin H. Oaks.
There are many political and social pressures for legal and policy changes to establish behaviors contrary to God's decrees about sexual morality and contrary to the eternal nature and purposes of marriage and childbearing. These pressures have already authorized same-gender marriages in various states and nations. Other pressures would confuse gender or homogenize those differences between men and women that are essential to accomplish God's great plan of happiness. Our understanding of God's plan and His doctrine gives us an eternal perspective that does not allow us to condone such behaviors or to find justification in the laws that permit them. And unlike other organizations that can change their policies and even their doctrines, our policies are determined by the truths God has identified as unchangeable.
John DeLynn, let me get to you.
Yeah.
How do you react to what you heard from Dallin Oaks?
Thanks, Doug. For my dissertation, we surveyed 1,615 Mormons and former Mormons who experienced same-sex attraction. And, you know, there are two overwhelming findings from that. Number one is that they don't choose to be gay or lesbian. And number two is that when they attempt to change it, it often can be catastrophic, including leading to suicide. And we also know that upwards of 70% of the LGBT Mormons end up leaving the church because they feel like it's not hospitable to them. So, this is a really good example of a little bit of a mixed message, because when President Holland talks about the severity of depression and how we need to reach out for it, what's ironic about it is the type of language that Elder Oaks uses regarding same-sex attraction, LGBT people, is the type of language that actually can drive that depression and even suicide among our gay, lesbian, and bisexual brothers and sisters in the church. I was also really saddened to hear him speak as if supporting same-sex marriage is incompatible with being a faithful LDS church member. I think that someone can have their own private views about what is moral and what is not, and be a devoted, committed church member, but still not believe that our religious viewpoints, our religious standards, should be imposed upon the rest of society, and prohibiting them from certain civil rights that are available to everybody else.
Rosalind Welch, was this one of the sour notes for you?
We heard Elder Oak sort of reiterating the sort of large-scale vision of human sexuality and family formation. This is familiar to us. This model regulates the sexual behavior of married straights. You heard him, a strong pronatal message. We need to procreate and have children, as well as regulating the sexual behavior of gays and singles, not with the same impact, of course. I hadn't seen any tea leaves suggesting that this was changing, so it didn't surprise me to hear this from him. I do want to separate the marriage issue, the gay marriage issue in particular, from another question, and that is the acceptance of gay Mormons into our congregations and communities. I do think we've seen wonderful progress forward on that aspect in the last little while, and I would hate for the very productive steps that are happening jointly between church leaders and sort of on-the-ground gay Mormons who are determined to stay and to make a new subject position for themselves as an active gay Mormon. That is how the church has always worked best, the sort of joint synergy between the top and the bottom. I think there are wonderful things happening there. I think the taboo surrounding homosexuality and gay identity within the church is dissolving little by little, and that fills me with hope. So I want to separate those two issues because I think there's a lot of reason for hope.
Joanna Brooks, has Dallin Oaks taken on the mantle of Boyd K. Packer? For those who are the uninitiated, he's the LDS General Authority, seen as the most doctrinaire, the most sort of traditionally orthodox or conservative. Is that the role he's taking?
Well, let's remember that Dallin Oaks, Elder Oak, had a distinguished career as a jurist. He is a legal thinker, and he has been at work literally for decades crafting legal positioning and theological positioning jointly that will preserve Mormon temple marriage ceremonies for straight couples only. And as marriage equality becomes the law of the land, we know Elder Oaks has been consulting with conservative legal thinkers to carve out a religious freedom defense retreat position to ensure that, to put forward arguments on theological grounds that say we can never, to protect the church potentially from being sued. That's the bogeyman that would come up. And this becomes especially pressing. We know that, the church had read in Priesthood and Relief Society meetings in Hawaii a letter encouraging members to weigh in on the question of marriage equality because the Hawaiian legislature will consider a marriage equity bill, in October. So we know the church is mindful state by state as marriage equality becomes the law of the land and is very, very protective of its own theological sovereignty. And I saw this talk just very much in that frame.
Let me ask you, finally, we don't have to tie all of this up in a bow or say anything definitive, but would you say for those looking for certain progressive progress within the church, was this a net gain, a net loss? Was it a wash? Rosalind Welch, what do you think?
You know, for me, actually, one of the most interesting moments of the conference came on Saturday morning, and that was when Elder Dubé from Zimbabwe and Elder Soares from Brazil both spoke. I was really struck by how they mixed anecdotes from North American church pioneer history and sort of African and South American anecdotes from the Global South. I think this is a really important area to watch as we think about how the church will move either progressively or conservatively in the future. And I don't think we know for sure which direction that ball will bounce, but I think it will have a lot to do with how the church grows in the Global South. So I think that's something to keep our eye on as we look to the future.
About a minute left. Joanna?
I agree 100% with Rosalind. There's a wonderful profile up at Ordained Women from a woman in Brazil saying, we simply don't have enough male leaders to help the church run in the Global South. The conversion rates have converts have been mostly among women. So the Global South, we need to keep in mind if we're charting the progressive future of the church.
John DeLynn, give you the final word.
Some want to call this two steps forward and two steps back. That's not how I look at it. I think that the brethren's have shown us that they're listening and that they're having a conversation amongst themselves about what to do about it. And I see that as very positive and hopeful going forward.
John DeLynn, creator of the Mormon Stories podcast, Joanna Brooks, blogs about Mormonism at religiondispatches.org, Rosalind Welch, blogs about Mormonism at Times and Seasons. Thank you all very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you, Doug.
Thanks, Doug.
And today we're posting a new video to our companion website, Video West. It's an online showcase of unique stories created by Utah filmmakers. We're going to be presenting a short documentary each week. And this week we have a piece called Tarkio Balloon by the Salt Lake City-based production company Oho Media. It's a family meditation on what it means to lose something and what we can gain by finding it again. Visit us at videowest.kuer.org. Radio West is a production of KUER News, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.